vile and polluting the deep blue of the otherwise empty sky. They twisted and coiled, blotting the air currents, worrying him. Gus sped up, watching the sky and road while a growing dread urged him on. Every bump in the highway traveled up the steering column and rattled him a little bit more. In seconds, he spotted the farm's dirt road and turned onto it just after 2:30 in the afternoon. Dirt sprayed from his tires. Unfilled potholes made his back teeth clatter. A flock of crows took to the sky, swearing at having to do so. The farm loomed into view, and Gus's innards crystallized at the sight. He braked, hearing the crackle of cold gravel underneath steel-belted rubber. The four corners of the main house stood charred and blackened, like greased spits over a low-burning fire. The blaze had consumed the house right down to its bones, where the interior was a smoking pile of unrecognizable debris. Part of the second floor sloped down to the ground level like a charcoal slide. Chrome gleamed from what remained of the kitchen, along with the singed hide of a once yellow refrigerator. Gus's breath sped up as if he'd burst into a sprint, even though he hadn't even put his ride into park. He did so a moment later, adrenaline flooding his system as he fumbled for the stick and swore when he finally got it right. Then he saw the bodies. He stumbled from the SUV and walked across the blood-stained ground as if gut-shot, whimpering in terror. Smoke drifted across the corpses, but Gus knew them. The sight of all those people he'd known switched him off in complete shock, like the sound of a 2-ton weight crashing down on an elegant set of piano keys right at his back. About 13 bodies sprawled on the ground, and he felt as if Donald had put one last arrow through the frontal jelly portion of his brain. Gus's knees buckled, and he plopped down on the gravel, staring at the corpses, seeing how the crows had violated them. He covered his mouth and stared until his eyes blazed red. "Oh, shit," he squeaked, grief rendering him breathless. "Oh, shit. Oh, oh, shit. Oh." Crows shrieked somewhere in the distance, their harsh cries sawing at reality. If he had a shotgun, he'd silence the whole goddamn works. But that swell of murderous intent receded, leaving him sitting and gawking at the rows of the dead, peeping out throat-constricted grunts of disbelief. They'd been executed, that much was clear. He wondered who had done it. Mortimer. Gus couldn't believe that. He'd left the old man to roast. Not even his ghost would know the location of the farm. Then another shot of fear, pure and mind-splitting, widened his red-rimmed eyes. "Oh, my shit," Gus whispered with emotion. He got up, staggered to the bodies, and tried to clarify what exactly he was seeing. Adam lay face down with a gaping hole in the back of his skull, blood caking and forever tarnishing the silvery gloss of his hair. Gus didn't turn him over for fear of seeing what the blast had done to his face. Anita Little lay two bodies over, her one eye as brown as the dirt she so closely studied in death. Her gray hair splayed around her shoulders in muddy strands, and memories assaulted Gus of how she'd fidgeted with her locks like a little girl. The others he recognized by hair, or body shape, or face, partially blotted by the ground. Corey, Emma, Louise, Art, Mike, Clara, Elmo. Gus stopped, palm wiping his eyes and nose. A rueful growl ripped from his chest, and he inspected the bodies again, forcing himself to continue. He had to make sure. No Maggie. No Roger. No Thelma. And no kids. Becky and Chad weren't among the dead, and that little burst of relief gave him strength. The thought came to him right then as he stood as still as a tombstone, that if anyone was lurking, he'd have known already. They could have picked him off. As it was, he'd only been gone overnight, not even 2 days, and the farm had been ravaged. He stepped back from the dead, noting how they'd been either shot or brutally bludgeoned to death. Mike Julian, a New Minas native Gus used to talk shop with, lay face down with his right hand hacked off. Tortured, perhaps. Gus walked around the dying fire pit of the house, spotting the dirt mound where his chair had toppled. A pair of boots jutted into the air, out of place against the far-off tree line. Roger lay on his back, staring at the sun with a bloody hole through his chest. The crows had been picking at his ruddy cheeks, plucking the eyes, displaying what hooked beaks could do to an unmoving knob of meaty flesh. Gus almost collapsed right there. But he didn't. He pushed on and confirmed four people were indeed unaccounted for among the deceased. So where were they? The question flared in his mind. Where were they? Gus frantically searched for signs of anything. Behind the house, around the equally torched barn, the storage sheds, and the immediate fields. The little storehouse full of harvested foods preserved for the winter had been razed to the ground. The root cellar remained intact, but emptied of its treasures. The few cars parked around the property had been cooked to husks, dashboards melted into grimaces. Most of the livestock, cows and goats, had been released to the fields, where they grazed peacefully, unconcerned with the deaths. The chickens were gone. And then he came to Adam's old beater of a sedan, roasted on the spot. A buzzing grew in his ears as Gus headed to his SUV. He jumped aboard the vehicle, started it, and was about to slam it into drive when the farm stopped him. The sad, shocking picture of it all. The smoking remains of his home and of the people with whom he'd shared it for almost 2 years slammed into his chest and robbed him of his voice. Have to bury them, he thought. Have to bury them. And he would. He swore he would. Swore to whatever ghosts were lurking nearby he'd return. The urge to leave grew almost irresistible, but then he composed himself with a mighty breath and got the machine rolling. I'll be back, he vowed. Tires spun dirt as he whipped the SUV around and rumbled to the main drag. Trees flashed by. Potholes made him bounce in his seat, his head nearly connecting with the ceiling. Questions raced through his mind. Who did this? Where were the missing people? Were they nearby? Dirt merged with pavement up ahead, and Gus still had enough presence of mind to spot a clue he'd missed. He slammed on the brakes and leaned over the steering wheel, barely hearing the idling of the motor. In the dirt lay the jagged parallel curves of tire tracks, tearing off the back road and peeling off on asphalt. A spray of gravel marked the speed and power the fleeing vehicle used. Gus could almost hear the yee-hawing as the driver gunned the pedal, shooting over pavement in a squeal of scalding rubber. Black scars marked the road, heading north on the 101. Toward Annapolis. Smoke. He'd been staring at smoke when he turned off the road, completely missing the obvious. Someone had come upon the farm, someone willing to kill, to loot. But why had they taken only four? The answer hit him between the eyes. He couldn't be sure about Becky and Chad, but Maggie was priceless. She was a doctor in the old world. She was also training Thelma as her nurse. In the new world, anyone would be hard-pressed to find such a valuable pair. They'd been kidnapped. Perhaps the kids were taken to be used as leverage to press Maggie into performing without argument. Gus looked ahead, measuring the curves in the road until trees on either side forbade his sight. The gas tank indicated half empty. Gripping the wheel, Gus stepped on the pedal and hauled ass up the highway, knowing he couldn't be any more than a day behind the killers. With the sun dipping, he stuck to the main highway and weaved around deserted cars, heading toward the city limits of Annapolis. He scanned the shoulders for clues, anything to let him know he was still on course. Despair took up residence in his mind as he knew searching the city could take weeks, something that he wasn't sure Maggie or Thelma or the kids had. The SUV crested a hill, and the decimated plate that was Annapolis lay before him. Even though he'd been higher than a Chinese satellite, purging the city by fire had seemed like a good idea at the time. But sober, Gus found it hard to gaze upon his handiwork. It had been his home at one time, after all, a city filled with memories, most good, some bad. Currently, it resembled a blackened tablecloth of steel and concrete, split wood and broken glass. Some of the taller buildings remained intact, casting tombstone shadows across an otherwise scorched landscape. The whole of the city seemed to stare back at him. Hateful. Remembering. Gus drove into the urban crater, determined to find Maggie, Thelma, and the kids. He became a steel and fiberglass missile aimed at the dead city's heart, rumbling with determination, revving willpower. The SUV coasted through the city's outer limits, Gus's face becoming a vengeful glower. Annapolis exuded waves of raw animosity like an unchecked radioactive core. Nothing walked. Debris littered the road and quickly imposed a slower speed. He saw the ruptured streets burst from beneath by powerful explosions of gas. All his handiwork. The city hated him. He knew it. Didn't give a damn. "Yeah, that's right," he muttered, taking a firmer grip on the wheel. "Your boy's back, bitch. Roll over and take it, and I'll leave quietly." A collection of cars littered the road, sparkling in the setting sun. Gus drove up on a sidewalk before steering back onto the main drag. "But make a move, and I swear to sunny Jesus I'll twist your tit so hard your ass'll squirt butter." A deadhead crawled right on the dotted line of the road. Its head was down, as if searching for its glasses at ground level. Gus didn't blink as he lined up a front tire and rolled right over the undead, feeling his tire pop the skull like an aerosol can tossed into an open fire. That was the only one. Nothing else crossed his path. "As well it shouldn't," Gus thought, and scratched his balls. Like a great beige shark, the SUV prowled through the sun-dried wounds and fissures of the streets, avoiding the arterial clogs of vehicles and taking the easier routes. The sun slipped from the sky, leaving a deepening evening blue. That worried Gus, agitating his misery over the missing people. Annapolis was the last place where he wanted to camp overnight. The thought of returning to his old house came to him, quickly dismissed with a snort that said, "Return to what?" He was too sentimental to go back anyway, knowing he'd bawl his eyes out if he ever laid eyes on the old homestead. Such distractions weren't needed. Not right then. An hour later, the sign for the 101 appeared in the glare of his headlights, and he drove for the highway. Annapolis, as far as one frantic pass could confirm, was empty of life. The open road beckoned. Chapter 13. Morning found Gus stopped just outside Windsor on a divided highway with a rusty-looking set of railroad tracks on his right. The Bay of Fundy tidal flats and saltwater marshes lay on his left. Tall yellow grass fluttered over mud banks singed with a collar of twinkling frost. The sun stared in through the driver's window like a police officer's flashlight, waking Gus none too gently. He'd slept in the SUV, seat lowered way back, with his baseball bat at the ready on the passenger side. The Nomex gear was a warm but bulky substitute for blankets. He'd cracked two windows, and while it wasn't home, it certainly could have been worse. Sleeping outside a couple of years before would have attracted a whole lot of flesh-eating attention. The morning faced him, and a pensive Gus stared back. He was in a hole, and the depth of that shit-shoot slowly dawned on him. Maggie and the rest could be anywhere in the province if they were still alive, and while there were only so many highways he could follow, the search would take time and burn gas, and every wrong turn meant lost ground. "Fuck me," Gus mulled in frustration, and eyed the unmoving traffic on the highway. Gone. They were gone, plucked from the farm while he was off searching for Talbert and his merry men. He cursed Talbert for going off to loot Mortimer's shack in the first place. If Talbert had stayed back, five men would have been defending the farm from the cold-blooded sons of bitches who'd gutted the place. The thought of never seeing Maggie, Thelma, and the kids ever again left him miserable. He got out and took a shivering piss on the side of the highway, gazing across a small body of water he wasn't sure was fresh water or salt, and saw a smattering of houses situated on the opposite hillside. Supplies. He'd need supplies. Whatever had been of value on the farm had been either stolen or burned to the ground, and Gus wasn't in the right frame of mind to root around ashes and memories to ferret out anything useful. He tapped himself off and zipped, flabbergasted he didn't even have so much as a single fucking roll of toilet paper to his name. But Windsor, the town gleaming in the distance, potentially did. Seconds later, the SUV rushed toward the sign designating the exit for the downtown section. Gus drove up a low hill and made the necessary turns before coasting into the outskirts of a commercial area. A few Victorian-styled houses, battered and flaking paint badly, stood on his left. A dusty Tim Hortons beamed at him from down a side street. Small businesses dotted the road on either side, occupying either single-story or taller buildings. Many of those were made of brick and metal and had only a few broken windows. A few doors lay open or ripped from their frames entirely. Gus eased his foot onto the brake. More cars and trucks stank up the road. A motorcycle appeared at one point, lying right on the solid line, chrome bright in the sunlight. Ripped saddlebags lay nearby, the contents long since scattered or stolen. Gus killed the engine and lowered his window. A light breeze breathed on him. Cold, but not uncomfortably so, and the sound of it struck a melancholy chord. It was Wednesday, or Thursday, and a bright morning in November. Pensions might have been deposited into bank accounts today, generating a brief shopping frenzy. The Tim Hortons would be bustling, and though he didn't really care for the coffee, one whiff of those percolating beans would have made him break down right there. Kids would be in school, maybe even testing before their Christmas break, so they'd be off the street. Bright morning chatter, casual sidewalk conversations, queries about last night's hockey scores or when Martok might be opening the ski slopes. Gus rubbed his chin and felt a sadness he'd thought had long since passed. The place was desolate, lifeless, a ghost town. Even the lack of gimps did nothing to alleviate the sense of emptiness. More than ever before, he felt he was about to violate a mass open grave. He couldn't remember ever being that way when he lived alone. Perhaps in the time spent on the farm, he'd become too accustomed to having people around, and that precious human contact had made him more sensitive to its absence. Gus sat up and bit on the inside of his cheek. His entire world had been shitbagged overnight. He had to revert back to how he'd been, living alone on the mountain when the undead walked instead of crawled. He laid on the horn and blasted that dreadful silence. Three times he sounded the horn, his eyes darting to the left, right, and rear, in case someone tried sneaking up on him. No one did, however. Not even after he waited 5 minutes. All right, then. Gus fired up his ride. The tires crackled over thin ice as it pulled alongside what looked to be a locally owned coffee shop, just a parking lot over from a sign announcing the Windsor Mall. Gus eyed the businesses listed on a roadside directory and stopped on one in particular, one that very much caught his attention. The leather shop. He studied his coat. Underneath, he wore jeans, a black sweater, and matching motorcycle boots. Christ. He was never one for fashion, so why change now? The air chilled him as he exited the vehicle, still wary of the streets. He took his bat and pulled on his helmet, wanting to find another with a visor, wondering if the mall might have something his size. The glass door to the coffee place opened with a squeak, and he paused on the threshold. Gus entered a small sitting area filled with undisturbed tables and chairs. Bare beams crossed the ceiling, and decorative wreaths hung around the walls, nearly in season once again. Gus wondered about that. The apocalypse had broken out around late summer. He'd put down many a gimp in bathing suits. Perhaps the wreaths were up all year, but they struck him as being totally Christmas. Bracing himself, he rapped the bat's head three times off the nearest table. "Hear that?" he asked the coffee shop, eyeing a small counter. Wire bins with torn sheets of wax paper lay behind the shattered glass displays. "Anyone in here, you godforsaken fucks?" No response. He crept forward, feeling nostalgic for house picking. Back in the days of living off the mountain, he'd actually had a perverse feeling of discovery when scouring for supplies in other people's property, a treasure hunter's rush of finding something useful. Handy goods could be anywhere. A quick search underneath the counter revealed nothing. The space underneath the barren cash register contained cupboards. Gus stopped at the swinging doors leading into the kitchen. Darkness ruled beyond, and he wasn't feeling particularly brave. "Hey," he barked, and slapped a door with the bat. It swung inward with a long squeal. Nothing moved. Gus went inside. He fumbled about until he discovered a washroom and three fresh rolls of toilet paper. A bottle of chemical cleaner was perhaps three-quarters full, as well as a pump bottle of soap that flowed like glue. Gus gathered up the toilet paper rolls and returned to daylight, stacking them on the counter. He found a few heavy sacks of flour mixture, clearly labeled for making muffins, in the back of the kitchen. He knew three bakers in the New World. Anita Little was one of them. A man named Larry had also lived on the farm, as well as Scott, whose whereabouts were utterly unknown. Two of them were dead. Gus supposed he could have traveled into Halifax and searched for Scott, but truthfully, he didn't want to see if the rat plague had reached the capital city, not after what he'd witnessed at his mountain fortress. Gus left the coffee shop with the toilet paper and one sack of muffin mixture and loaded up the SUV. The crap wrap went into the back seat as he kidded himself that he had enough for a month if he stayed off the booze. The mall was next. The metal grate of the entrance protecting the glass doors had been smashed aside and left hanging like a drooping blind, as if someone had rammed a truck through it all. Gus parked and got out, grimacing at the mess. Dull glass glittered and crackled underfoot. Shriveled bodies carpeted the floor and walls as if the whole town had sought shelter at the mall. Some had their skulls smashed in or removed entirely from their neck. A breeze, full of regret, sighed through the shadowy cavern of steel and concrete and glass. One carcass, a mall cop by his uniform, sat with his back against the wall just inside the entrance. He stirred and lifted his chin slowly. Gus watched the dead thing's attempt to wheel its limbs into motion. The face resembled a melted mask, blackened and frightening. Gus crushed the head with a boot heel, grunted at having to stretch a leg up so high, and awkwardly regained his balance. A clump of scalp matter clung to his boot. Gus made a face at the clinging flesh and stomped, which didn't dislodge the rag of skin. Huffing in disgust, he dragged his foot over the twinkling glass, then wiped it on another body wearing a shirt and pants, and yet another body with a denim jacket. At first, his efforts were slow and deliberate, but as he repeatedly failed to clean his boot, he put more exasperated energy into the swipes. "God damn it," he swore and tried to ignore it. The trouble was, he could feel the scalp dragging along with each step. Gus grunted in annoyance, placed a hand against a wall for support, and used the other boot to vigorously pin the scalp to the floor and rip it away. He freed himself in a few seconds, test-walked, and found his stride returned to normal. "Worse than dog shit," Gus muttered, making a note never to stomp in ahead ever again. Movement, then. Even in the dim, cavernous halls of that retail crypt, he picked up on crawlers and drew back a few steps. At the absolute edges of the dark, fingers slinked into view and clawed at the floor. Gus waited, but nothing came out of the dark. Realizing the zombies couldn't move, Gus still retreated a few more steps toward daylight. Something about those fingers moving like stunned crabs repulsed him, creeped him out. He needed a flashlight. No way he was going to go someplace dark without one. Not after what had happened at Mortimer's. He got aboard the SUV and drove off, cruising the downtown area for a hardware shop. The minutes dragged on, and he realized he was wasting time, so he decided to go back to the basics and stopped at the first house on his right. He didn't mind little houses like this gray-painted two-story Victorian. A sunroom faced a front lawn that might have been the envy of the town back when people still lived. The grass had grown unchecked to knee height and presently bent over with frost. Gus got to work. By mid-morning, he'd picked his way through four such homes, encountering not one gimp in his search, and locating a heavy, rubber-grip flashlight that took four D-cells. Gus thumbed the switch, but the beam was too weak to be of any use. Pocketing the flashlight, he went on the hunt for better batteries. He didn't find any, but he did pick up two cloth grocery bags, the environmentally friendly kinds, and stuffed in a kettle, along with five boxes of dried cheese-flavored Kraft dinner. He grabbed a set of Tupperware from a kitchen, including a set of spoons, forks, and knives. A can opener also went into a bag. On the second trip, he snatched a mid-sized pot and a no-stick frying pan. Gus paused and listened each time he returned to the SUV in the street. Bodies, like wisps of cloth and skin, ravaged by the elements over the years, lay face down or on their sides. Nothing moved, and Gus remembered what Talbert and his boys had reported to the folks on the farm. The dead weren't a problem anymore. Not in the least. The rear of the SUV quickly filled with supplies, and Gus took stock of everything before getting inside and driving a little farther down to the next collection of houses. He could have walked, but didn't feel like leaving his ride too far behind him. That tempted fate. And Gus needed her on his side. He parked ass first in a paved driveway, driver's side lined up with the front door. This house gave up some duvets, which he heaped into the back seat, four plastic liter water jugs, and another two rolls of toilet paper. A rifle was also present in the living room, held in the papery hand of the individual who'd last used it to exit the world via gunshot. The top half of the skull appeared like a broken flower pot, and Gus wondered why the hell the long gone wore smiles in the afterlife. Those eerie grins spoke to him, last messages to the living. The guy had a family gathered around. Two children with weedy hair clinging to their heads. They sat on a sofa with blown-apart pillowcases over their heads, while the wife relaxed in a stretched-out recliner sporting a hunting rifle hairdo. One more family who had decided that the easiest way out was suicide. Gus moved on, trying not to dwell on it. Unable to find any ammunition, he left the firearm. Also, prying the item free from the guy's fingers seemed like bad mojo. A basement door opened without a problem, and Gus peered down carpeted steps to a landing, a discarded slipper, and blackness beyond. He didn't like going into basements, and that one felt spooky. He took two steps down, hating the squeal of old wood, and thought, "Fuck it," before returning to the kitchen. Cans of food lay stacked in cupboards, but he left those, wary of long-expired dates. One cabinet hid a heavy-duty spotlight flashlight with a weak beam, the lithium battery near the end of its existence but still serviceable. After finding little in the kitchen, he wandered back to the basement stairs, took a none-too-pleased breath, and went down. The slipper on the landing wasn't a slipper at all. It was a crushed rat. The discovery froze Gus on the steps. He swung the flashlight beam throughout the rest of the basement, sweeping it one way and then the other, seeing other squashed invaders.
"Little shitstains better not be down there," Gus warned. "You hear me? You better not."
He toe-flicked the unmoving fur stains of the rats, screwing up his face, glad he wore boots. The wavering beam illuminated a good section of the basement and revealed a laundry area and a washroom, another four rolls of crap wrap. A short hall led to a stylish arch with a rec room beyond, containing a modest gym, a pool table, and a comfy-looking sofa set arranged around a widescreen TV and a fireplace. A discarded duffel bag lay crumpled in one corner, and Gus prodded it repeatedly before opening and examining its folds. Ancient hockey gear filled it, which he emptied onto the floor. He wasn't that much of a pack rat just yet. He clacked the cue ball off a knot of multicolored cousins and listened to the resulting soft chatter. Poking around revealed a stack of National Geographics, but nothing else of interest. The rats appeared to originate from a displaced drainpipe, which Gus believed was the only entry point in the whole basement. No shells for the rifle. The toilet paper came with him, and already his asshole felt that much more loved. Gus stashed everything in the duffel bag and returned to the surface. The larger flashlight would have to do until he found something better. He saddled up and drove back to the Windsor Mall. Chapter 14. The lack of noise seemed to hum in his ears. Gus stood at the dark mouth of the mall's entrance. Geared up and carrying his flashlight, he paused before thumbing the power switch. The beam flared to life, making the search seem official, and he cautiously walked inside.
"Hey," he yelled after walking 10 feet into the retail cave. "Just taking a look around is all. Doing a little shopping on credit. That's all. So stay the fuck back."
He waited, fidgeting on the crinkling glass. The bodies carpeting the floor didn't move. The police officer lay toppled on his side.
"Fuck it," Gus muttered and moved deeper, getting a better grip on his bat.
The beam revealed withered heaps of cloth and flesh, which he navigated past, feeling more than a little nervous. He passed a huge, smashed bulb containing a crane and claw and plush toys. Furry little limbs stuck out from the scruffy-looking mass. Gum and candy dispensers stood in a two-tiered wall, cracked open, their booty scooped out. More ravaged bodies. He flashed the beam toward a clearance sale sign outside an Eager Andy's chain store. A mound of corpses blocked the glass doors from closing. One of the bodies, a ghoul dressed in a white T-shirt and cargo shorts, slid off the top with all the grace of a crocodile taking to water. Its blackened skin appeared leathery in the light. Gus speared its skull with one quick jab. Two more crawlers attempted to pull themselves out of the flesh heap before Eager Andy's discount shop, but the weight of the dead piled atop their lower spines prevented them from reaching freedom. Stick-like arms fluttered weakly in the flashlight's beam as if searching for car keys. Gus dispatched those as well. Tables came into view farther along the corridor, filled with waxy smokestacks of candles, some tall, some reduced to puddles. The residents had turned the place into a refuge of sorts until it was finally breached. Gus found a box of long-necked barbecue lighters on one table, which he stuffed into the duffel bag. He then regarded Eager Andy's, wondering what the hell Andy had been so damn eager about, and climbed over the clump of carcasses blocking the entrance to the shop. The dead cluttered the wide aisles. Gus waded through, having to go around heaps of unmoving flesh at times. The shelves still contained some household knickknacks, but nothing that grabbed his attention. "Hurry," his mind urged. 5 minutes later, he gave up and hunted for the leather shop. The glass doors to the hole-in-the-wall outlet lay wide open. He ignored the fancy bags, wallets, and shoes,
and homed in on the pants. A quick search brought up two pairs his size and another two pairs of a size a little bigger so he could double bag himself. A biker jacket hung off a rack, a little too large for him, but with an underlayer of a sweater or something, it would be perfect. These he grabbed, as well as a pair of belts. With his booty, he made his exit. A head or two lifted weakly, as if pulled up by their scalps, but Gus didn't bother engaging them, focused on the glowing entrance and the parked SUV. He walked, hairs on his neck standing on end, waiting for unseen deadheads to pounce. But nothing did. Once more, Gus loaded and arranged his booty in the rear of his vehicle. Sweat soaked his clothes underneath the Nomex. He gazed back at the depths of the mall and mulled over his next move. The sun beamed overhead, marking noon. It was time to leave and get searching. Gus just wasn't sure of where to go. He left Windsor, driving back to the 101. As the town disappeared in his rearview mirror, dreadful doubts uncoiled in Gus's mind. Too much time had passed. He'd taken too long with his modest outfitting. The trail might have gone cold. The idea that the killers hadn't holed up in Annapolis seemed solid, but it only made him wary about following the highway down into Halifax. If any time remained at all, Maggie and the others didn't have much. The kilometers whispered past in the barely heard hum of tire rubber. An abandoned collection of metal and glass periodically tangled the highway, forcing him to drive slowly. Gus's stomach informed him it was about to tear a rib off if he didn't eat soon. He couldn't remember when he'd eaten last. Has a day passed? When did I last eat? There were 5 boxes of KD in the back, and he had the means of cooking the noodles. All he needed was water. Rolling timberland rose up on both sides of the highway. A dirt road passed by on his right, snaking through the brush to parts unknown. A blue sign stood on the shoulder, informing him that exit 3 was approaching. But that didn't interest him at all. The next sight did. Gus stopped on top of an overpass with a lonely squeal of brake pads and got out. Feeling like the last man on the planet, he eyed a small body of water to the right of the lanes running underneath. A large 18-wheeler was nose down in the ditch on the opposite side of the highway. The long container had stayed upright but jackknifed across 2 lanes, with the hood of a car lodged between a set of trailer tires. 4 smaller cars were scattered around it. Gus gazed up and down the divided highway, seeing no movement and hearing nothing. He shook his head in wonder at the spectacle below the overpass. The road had seen some excitement. He could make out the head of the truck driver, face down on his steering wheel, as if bashing his forehead in frustration. Gus returned to his vehicle, backed up, and drove down exit 3. He stopped along the cement wall bordering the pond, got out, hopped the barrier, and made his way down to the water's edge. He sampled it, swishing a mouthful around before swallowing, and hoped it didn't give him cramps or worse. More went down the hatch, and when he'd drunk his fill, he got to work. Gus warily filled the 3 jugs and a cooking pot. It took a couple of trips, but he carried the water back to the SUV, as well as some brushwood he'd picked up along the highway. A short time later, he started a small campfire with the butane lighters. There was nothing to hang the pot from, so he held his handle with his gloved hand until the water boiled, wishing he'd had the foresight to grab a grill. The trailer kept drawing his attention. The Kraft dinner cooked in a short time, the powdered cheese plopping into the mixture like an orange nugget. There was no milk or butter, and he could taste the age of the macaroni, but it went down fine. A small amount of leftovers went into a Tupperware dish. Once fed, Gus let the fire burn itself out while he studied the tractor trailer across the quiet lanes. He pulled out his bat and regarded the vehicle. That lengthy, white storage box called to him. His boot heels clicked on cracked pavement as he crossed the highway, checking both ways, making a mental note to inspect the cars for fuel. Though the cars of the day had security measures to prevent the siphoning of tanks, There was no safeguard in place to prevent him from cutting into the gas tanks. Fuel stabilizers and other additive mixtures still kept octane levels high well after the apocalypse. With the millions of combustion engines abandoned and cluttering roadways housed within stylish fiberglass and carbon fiber shells, finding a fuel source wasn't difficult. It was only a matter of drilling into a tank and having a receptacle in place, or drop cloths, to soak up the gas. Gus didn't have a drill, but he did have a hammer and spike, which would get him into most plastic tanks. The metal ones ran the risk of sparking when he punctured the tank. But after 4 years, he was still popping. But all that would happen after he checked out the trailer. He crossed a sloping median of yellow grass. A few shriveled bodies decorated the asphalt like fallen scarecrows. The door to the truck's cab lay open, the seat buckle keeping it from closing properly. Gus pulled it open, ready to be jumped. But when nothing happened, he hauled himself inside, pushing the dead driver aside, and took a look around. A neat bunk with barely a sheet out of place tempted him to stop for the night. He searched a set of panel wood drawers and left the canned food therein. A notepad PC had swung out on a platform attached to the bed, and when Gus pushed it, he discovered suction cups keeping it in place. Overhead compartments spilled clothing when opened. The rig was an automatic stick shift, but the dash was a mystery of dials and gauges that he left alone. The sound of his heels slamming the pavement carried, enough for him to stop and listen. Feeling overly paranoid, Gus went to the rear of the trailer, sensing a prize within. He ducked under an open door of the trailer and spotted a ring of rocks marking a fire pit on the pavement. He pondered that for a second before looking into a spacious cavern on wheels, stocked with a living room set. Gus pulled himself into the interior and inspected a deep earth-brown sofa that had its protective covering torn away, its cushions stained. The corners of a wooden coffee table were scuffed bare. Dusty boot prints tracked across the flooring, at least 4 different treads. A posh, queen-size bed lay at the back. The mattress's plastic covering had been torn off, and boot prints stained the cloth surface as if someone had worn their footwear while sleeping. Someone had used the trailer as a very comfortable campsite, right across from a nearby water supply. Gus turned to leave when he spotted, sticking out behind a black sedan, a pair of very small feet wearing slippers with scuffed bottoms, toes down in the dirt. Getting bad vibes, Gus hopped out of the trailer and cautiously approached the body. He edged around the car and stopped with a chill. The gaping hole in the back of the woman's head momentarily distracted him from recognizing her gray hair. When he realized he'd found Thelma, the air left his lungs, and he slumped against the car. Sweat coated him in a cold, miserable dew. After a moment, he rolled her over to confirm it was her. Wide eyes stared back, flat and lifeless and caked with dirt. In death, she appeared utterly shocked, her little mouth open as if she hadn't expected the trigger to be pulled. Well, Jesus. Feeling weepy and sick to his stomach, Gus lifted her and transported her to the back seat of the black sedan. With infinite care, he tucked in her legs, tried unsuccessfully to close her eyes, and covered her with a blanket from the trunk. Her limbs weren't stiff just yet, and the skies were without crows, so she hadn't been dead for very long. He closed all the doors and windows and gazed in at her, feeling like a cold shit for leaving her that way. "I'm sorry, Thelm," his voice rasped. "I'm sorry. At least the birds won't get you. Or anything else. And it's not a bad car. A good stereo system." He meant every word. He smiled weakly. "Anyway, you just sleep now. Thanks for the sign. I'll see if I can find Maggie and the kids. They're still out there somewhere, and it's a mighty big province. God willing, I'll find them, and I'll bring them back." To where? Haven't gotten to that part just yet, he sighed, shoulders heaving. But I'll work on it. Emotionally drained, Gus ran a hand over the car roof and gave it a final pat. He returned to his vehicle and strapped himself in, frowning at the road ahead. Halifax called. It was absolutely the last place he wanted to go, a hellish maze of urban planning gone bad, but he had to travel there for the sake of Maggie and the kids. The sun slipped behind a dark cloud as he fired up the engine. The road thickened with abandoned vehicles the closer Gus got to Halifax. He slowed to a crawl, threading his way through bottlenecks that nearly strangled the roads of Lower Sackville. Cars had become above-ground coffins for their occupants, the highway transformed into a collage of dull metallic roofs and open doors.
Jesus, Gus hissed in awe.
The main drag in Annapolis had been bad, but the highway to Halifax was horrific. The scary thing was that he wasn't even in the city yet, let alone downtown. The magnitude of his quest suddenly threatened to overwhelm him.
Anywhere. They could be any fucking where.
Gus forced the despair down. He was going to find them. Wrecked gas stations, rows of houses, and a line of ubiquitous chain restaurants rolled by, reminding him he still had a little leftover Kraft dinner. An exit turned off toward what appeared to be a collection of stores like Walmart and Mark's Work Warehouse. A sign advertised indoor track go-kart racing in front of an enormous three-story box of a building. Downed power lines draped a pickup truck, a black husk of an arm hanging out of its open window, an attached head thrown back in a maniacal chortle. The deeper Gus drove down that highway of haunts, the more uneasy he became. Anytime he went down into Annapolis, he'd made good and certain he drank a certain armoring amount of Grandpa's special sauce. On the farm, he'd fought down those urges that periodically gripped him. He wasn't an alcoholic. Not in the least. But the memory of how he used to deal with the horrors of the days gone by tempted him. Made him want. Wish. He kept his speed down, driving like the only float in a stalled parade. Daylight waned, and the dash clock said it was a little after 4. No way was he driving around that graveyard at night. The SUV swung onto an off-ramp for Lower Sackville's residential area and rolled down a road crowded with houses on either side. Front lawns grew wild, some high enough to tickle the bottoms of sills. A few cars filled driveways. A pickup had parked itself uncomfortably over a fallen power transformer. A sign displaying Hallmark Avenue strolled by. And Gus absently thought about birthday cards. Dark bodies in the road brought him back, and his tires rolled over the dead already flattened into the asphalt. He wanted a house for the night. One as easy to defend as possible. All he saw were split-level designs. Split levels and more split levels. Jesus Christ. The developer must have had a split-level hard-on. Gus snaked his way through the streets until he stopped in a cul-de-sac directly in front of a two-story house with a double garage. It wasn't his first choice, but then, with the common theme of houses on the street, he probably wasn't going to find anything better. He backed into the driveway and stopped before the garage door. Gus still wore his bulky Nomex and left his ride's nose pointed toward the highway for a quick getaway. A plump propane tank stood at the side of the house and gave him fiery flashbacks to another time. Bat in hand, he walked to the front door and tried the knob. Locked. Gus stood back and knocked, just in case. While waiting, he sized up the other houses nearby and thought about checking them later. No one answered. But that didn't always mean anything. Gus walked around the back, ignoring the patio stones and the grass fringing each square. He stepped onto a stained deck, studied the glasswork of a sliding door, and smashed the section near the lock. In a second, he entered the home and closed the door behind.
"Anyone home?" he asked,
sniffing at the end of the question and adjusting his helmet. No answer. Gus strode into a modern kitchen, circled the marble island, and peeked inside the fridge and nearby cupboards. Finding nothing, he wondered if the owners had left in a hurry. He left the kitchen and wandered through a comfortable living room with a gas fireplace and a thick rug that might have cost hundreds of dollars. A small plastic castle lay in one corner. A little dollhouse lay on its side and stared brightly at the ceiling. Young kids, Gus figured. Memories of the hospital and crazy bitch Alice entered his mind. His balls still ached from that encounter. He tapped the castle with a toe and regarded the staircases with a melancholy air. Jesus, he hoped the family reached someplace safe. For some reason, the castle and the toy house upset him more than he thought possible. Perhaps it was the thought that little Becky would enjoy herself there, or it might be that after having been around children for the past couple of years, when they were gone, when anyone's children were gone, the space they'd once filled seemed all the more empty, and just a little more drab. Leaving a few toys on the floor might entice the rightful owners to come back. Gus grunted and stood behind a thin veil of drapes over the picture window. This he liked, a clear view of anyone coming into the cul-de-sac. He climbed the stairs to the second floor and meandered through, searching for deadheads and relieved to find it empty. Not even a rat. A chest of drawers in a little girl's room had been cleaned out as if someone had left in an awful hurry. The same went for the little boy's room, Mom and Dad's, and the closets. The garage was also bare. He wondered where the family had gone. Wondered how far they got. Gus retraced his steps to the living room and plopped down on the sofa with a direct line of vision of the cul-de-sac. Listened. Heard not a thing, except that drone deep in the ear canal that manifests in the absence of noise. Gus waited, watched. After his break, he opened the garage and parked the SUV inside out of sight. The garage had a few gardening tools that he thought about taking, some duct tape, and a peg wall full of useful tools and items, but then he thought of the children's castle. No, he wasn't going to take anything from this place. Breaking the window had already tainted this seemingly content little home. Even though the owners were gone, even though Gus had never hesitated cleaning out a house before, a spirit lingered in that place. Taking something would feel like swiping something from a church. But if it was all right, and he hoped it would be, he would stay the night and leave in the morning. He ate the leftover KD at the kitchen table, his working flashlight sitting nearby if it got too dark. 5 packets of dried noodles, the ones with the granulated flavor packs, had been left in a cupboard. Gus took them, hoping whoever owned the place wouldn't mind that either. Once he'd finished with supper, he explored the other cupboards, finding dishes and boxes of long dried-out cereal. The cupboard above a blue bread box held a surprise, however. Gus opened it and stared slack-jawed at a bottle of Captain Morgan's Amber Rum. The decorative logo was changed somewhat from the usual figure to an enlarged face of the mustachioed sailor, one corner of his wide-brimmed hat drooping quite dashingly over an eye. The welcoming smile on the old naval officer damn near glowed in the dark of the cupboard, as if Gus was the very person he'd been waiting for. Well, shit. Gus's mind balked. The pirate's shrunken head stared right at him. That wasn't an entirely bad thing, not in the least. In fact, in that hour of need, he welcomed the officer's familiar presence. Hello, my buddy. Gus whispered, just standing and staring at the bottle. Been a long time. The captain didn't answer. That's okay. That's fine. Hell, I'd be more worried if you did start talking back. Gus gently extracted the plastic container, studying the label, reading the alcohol content, where it was distilled. All good information to know, and damn it if he wasn't just a bit tempted to have a chug. The bottle was full, the seal unbroken, and the liquid gold sloshed against the plastic. Gus wasn't an alky,
He'd proved that over the time spent on the farm.
Not on the farm anymore, a voice whispered.
No, he said, eyeing the captain's merry features.
No, I'm certainly not. Oh my, oh my.
Gus walked with the seafaring officer to the sofa, sat down heavily, and scratched two of his dearest buddies. He stared at the face in the darkening room. The bottle was only a small quart, 375 milliliters, or as the Newfoundlanders would say, a flask. But the appearance of the captain calmed Gus in a way he'd never thought possible. The last time he'd felt so pleasantly surprised was perhaps a Christmas morning with Tammy, discovering Santa had deposited a similar bottle in his red stocking. Gus sat and stared at the captain's grinning features. He ran a thumb over the surface of the bottle, and the liquid trembled, ever so slightly.
What to do? He whispered, smiling at the question. What to do?
Chapter 15.
I heard something out there, man.
Sherman Wayward regarded the starless night before leveling his gaze to the road. A light breeze whisked past his ears, frigging his hearing for a moment, and he was about to say as much to his guard post companion Raymond Cole, who was almost shapeless in the dark, when he did catch the barest rumble of noise. Long and huffing at times. Mechanical.
You hear that? Raymond asked.
Yeah, Sherman said.
That's a motor.
Sherman didn't respond right away. He kept on listening, leaning over the hood of his car and staring off into the blackness. The rumbling became louder, deepened.
That's not one motor, he muttered as it dawned on him. Those are motors.
Who the hell is it then?
Fuck if I know.
Should I get Pat?
Patrick Riley was the de facto leader of the little community of 44 people living just off the 105 in New Brunswick. Over the past few years, they'd been surviving the zombie apocalypse by avoiding the death traps of St. John, Moncton, and Fredericton, and keeping to the outskirts of the smaller communities, hiding at the ends of back roads and becoming semi-nomadic. At the peak of the zombie plague, they'd driven in trailers from park to park, creating defensive zones with the people and equipment they had, and conducting sorties into nearby towns for food and essential goods. Riley had traveled the province over in his scarred Winnebago, keeping to the less traveled roads, and gathered his little troop of survivors as he drove along. The sound of his home on wheels had attracted the remnants of humanity like an ice cream truck. Eventually, they settled temporarily on a deserted farm just off the 105, situated in the St. John River Valley, and there they'd stayed for 2 years, situated on a low plateau facing the wide St. John River, which would twinkle like diamonds under full moons. A single dirt lane sloped down from the house and parked trailers to the guard post deemed necessary day and night. A chest-high wooden fence faced the main road, another feature the inhabitants of the farm appreciated. There had been a few situations with outlaws, but nothing the little community couldn't handle. But tonight was different. Somber flashes of metal could occasionally be seen through the inky dark, moving along the 105 with the slow-moving grace of a train. As it was November, the night air promised to bite if offered bare skin. Sherman sniffed at times, clearing his sinus cavity of running mucus.
The fuck is that? He asked,
every bit as perplexed as Raymond beside him. If things got bad, the practice drill was to reach in through the open window of the parked Accord and sound the horn. Sherman moved to that very station, shaking his head in wonder.
Maybe it's someone coming in? Raymond asked.
Who the hell's coming here this time of night?
Blow the horn?
Sherman nodded and reached for the steering wheel, sending a surge of relief through his companion. Sherman was keeping his eyes on whatever was coming up the 105 when he heard a short, indignant gurgle from Raymond, as if a dentist's drill had slipped and speared the back of his throat.
It evaporated into a squeaky puff of breath. Confusion gripped Sherman, and he glanced over his shoulder to see Raymond slump to the ground. A shadow blurred forward, and Sherman had just enough time to gasp before a length of knife stabbed deep into his right eye, delivering a split second of pain not unlike being zapped with a few thousand volts. He flopped to his knees and got held for a moment before being gently lowered. Sherman was dead before he touched the dirt, his brain scrambled by 6 inches of razor-sharp steel. A wraith stood and wistfully regarded the little community on the hill. His companions called him Sick, and his name, as well as his reputation, was rightly earned. Sick could discern no sign of alarm, primarily because of the growing motorized drone in the background. He furtively wiped off the knife on his victim's clothes and stepped up to the open window of the Accord. Sick looked around, confirming his task had been completed, before laying on the horn. 3 quick, startling toots. In answer, the 105 became a tower of headlights and overhead spotlights. The beams blazed through the dark like lasers fired from the face of a monstrous spider, and if Sherman or Raymond had still been alive to see the show, they would have been struck speechless once again. For the wall of lights seemingly rose up from the ground to the height of a 3-story building. The ground-level beams fluttered as figures passed before them, crouched over like commandos. The fight was over before it began. No one fired any shots until people started coming out of their trailers and motorhomes, and when they did, seeing the monstrous light show at the bottom of the hill rendered them speechless. Then the first chatter of gunfire rang out, and voices commanded everyone to drop to their knees. 3 of Riley's people had responded with semi-automatic pistol fire, peppering the night with the hurried pop of firecrackers. 1 person raced toward the barn near the rear of the property, only to be cut down by a curt son-of-a-bitch burst from an assault rifle. The remaining defenders died after a brief gun battle. The rest of Riley's group surrendered without incident. Camouflaged soldiers quickly rounded up the remaining people. They forced the captured souls to lay flat on the ground, face down, their limbs spread out nice and wide under baleful spotlights. A handful of children lay on their bellies as well, mewling and sniveling and hitching in eyes-shut terror. Every now and again a gunshot punctuated the air, and the kids screamed.
"Shut those little shits up!"
Shovel commanded in a sonorous voice, appearing almost magically from the flood of light. Times like that one were the worst, and understandably so. Those folks had been sleeping only minutes earlier, and now they were wrangled together and planted face down in the dirt without a clue as to what was going on. Some of them might have even been getting around to fucking. The children sure as hell didn't know what was happening, only that their parents, real or adopted, had burst into their rooms and hurried them out the door into a night that was positively shocking after the warmth of their beds. Shovel had to admit it was harsh, but then again, it was a harsh world. A soldier moved to the wailing youngsters and made an example of a little girl, swatting her upside the head. She shrieked. The mother shrieked. The father bellowed, "Leave her alone!" and got to his knees. One of Shovel's men stitched a killing line up the dad's back, smacking him face down in the dirt. The mother truly freaked then and jumped up surprisingly fast. In another burst of light, she jigged backward while chunks punched out of her back. Cordite lingered in the air. The kid wailed on until a woman hugged the little one close, muffling her nearly feral crying. Shovel didn't chastise the slayings. His men had orders to start popping anyone who sang above acceptable decibels. Once unleashed, they wouldn't ease up until deeds were done and the law laid down. Shovel's job was to lay down that law. He brooded, decked out in a winter coat and ski mask, much like the others in his little army. A compact but ugly submachine gun hung from a shoulder strap across his midsection, an old Heckler & Koch automatic. Some of his followers had full-blown soldier uniforms taken from overrun depots, since people seemed to think the army was a good thing. It worked quite effectively as a ruse until, surprise,
folks realized they weren't soldiers at all. In another life, the core of Shovel's pack had been rig pigs, roughnecks, oil and gas workers situated in the far north where only desolate tundra and stunted wilderness kept the apocalypse at bay. And Shovel, he'd lorded over them all. His bulked-up shadow spread across the flattened prisoners like a monolithic stone threatening to topple over.
"Listen now," Shovel began in that deep, liquid-gold voice that belonged way in the back of a cathedral choir. "Listen, because for some of you, your very lives depend on it. Listen."
They listened. 20 men fenced in the prisoners lying on their bellies. They were armed with an assortment of high-tech, military-grade weapons, all trained upon the people at their feet. Balaclavas, black ski masks worn by counter-terrorism operators, hid their features, dehumanizing them. The smell of fecal matter perfumed the air. Shovel made a face. It happened every fucking time.
"The world, as you know it, has ended," he continued, screwing up his face at the stink. "There are no more credit ratings, no more mortgages, no more public systems, and no more online shopping. But there's still debt. A fuckload to pay. To settle. In a new currency." Neighbor turned against neighbor. Old empires fell and new ones struggled to rise. And the dead ate the living, as fucked up as that sounds. Listen to me, listen. The dead ate the living. And in some cases, the living, he let that hang for a moment, ate the living, as fucked up as that sounds.
He paused then, allowing that sentiment to sink in and percolate.
"Because of our isolated location," Shovel went on, his voice hypnotic, "me and the group around you missed out on most of what happened. Lucky you, you might think. Well, we had our own troubles, our own desperate times. But we overcame them. And once we overcame them, we rallied together and descended upon the warmer lands, riding hard from our northern hell. We descended upon the insane and the refuse and the warlords and the petty men of might, and we struck them down. It was a bloody time, a chaotic time. But we prevailed. By the way, did you know that the Prime Minister even attempted to reestablish order in his kingdom? He did, if you can believe it. Hiding away in a bunker, he actually sent out teams of soldiers, special soldiers, mind you, to help